Welcome to the Public Morality. In the mid-1970s, the Republican Party looked on the verge of self-destruction. It was marred by a razor-close and deeply personal battle for the Republican nomination and the party's identity. But the GOP resurrected itself, becoming a staunch conservative party as it eventually pulled the country toward the right. Landslide is the story of the closest presidential primary race in American history in 1976. What followed and how it reshaped the political parties opened the partisan rift that divides us today. We are joined by its host and creator, award-winning public radio journalist, Ben Bradford. Ben Bradford, welcome to the Public Morality.
Thanks for having me.
I want to begin by having you just briefly define the series Landslide. What is it? Why? And what's the connection to the present moment?
Yeah, absolutely. So Landslide, on one hand, is the story of an old, I think, often forgotten presidential race, which is the 1976 presidential race. That's one of our sleepier races in some ways. It did not have great turnout. It is Gerald Ford and Jimmy Carter, probably not considered two of our most, you know, sparkling and exciting presidents that we're facing off. And so on one hand, that may sound pretty boring and sleepy. And on the other hand, thematically, there is a clear line going from that election and that cycle to today's political parties and today's partisan gulf, right? I mean, this sort of thing that we've seen happen with our political parties where we've divided into two tribes, not just two teams, and where people are so divided on almost every conceivable issue. So that in sum is what Landslide is looking at. And we do that primarily over the course of the first half of the season by looking at Gerald Ford, who is the unelected president after Watergate, kind of trying to hold the country together at this time when public trust is collapsing. And, you know, you're after Watergate, the end of Vietnam, the Vietnam War. And he's trying to kind of hold the country together. His view is that he needs to kind of bring people together. And he's challenged in the primaries, which was just really not done to incumbent presidents at the time, by this one time, this guy had been a governor for 8 years, but was really more well known as an actor, which was Ronald Reagan. And Ford versus Reagan is the closest presidential primary race in history. So that's what Landslide is about. And then we go through from that into Jimmy Carter, who's also interesting as he rockets through the Democratic field until Ford and Carter face off, which actually has major implications for the kinds of candidates we elect, ultimately culminating with Carter versus Reagan in 1980. And I think that one of the big questions of the series is exploring who Reagan was, how he was viewed at the time, which is so different, I think, from his popular image today, and looking at how he went from essentially being considered a radical, fringe, lightweight candidate to winning a landslide.
Listening to Landslide, I was reminded of a quote often attributed to Mark Twain: history doesn't repeat itself, but it often rhymes.
Yeah.
1976 may not replicate 2024 exactly, but there are some undeniable overlaps. Can you speak to those?
Yeah. I think that one of the things that you're alluding to is when you listen through the series, and one of the things that we spend a lot of time doing, and I think the kind of the focus of the series is going back through to what was it like at the time. So you hear a lot of archival footage that is essentially bringing you back there and kind of helping proof a lot of the things that we say that you otherwise might not believe about what was going on. And the other thing is that then you're hearing these resonances with today. So I think that there are a few things. You know, one of the things that you'll hear later on. We haven't quite gotten to them yet. You'll hear these candidates who are sort of outsider candidates challenging the establishment, who keep using this phrase, which is some variation of make America great again. And I use that as an example of kind of what you hear in the series, because I do think that you hear resonances like that today that either have taken on different meanings or have the same meaning. You know, for instance, candidates using law and order or attacking what's in textbooks to try to rile up a coalition of voters to come out and win. So I think that that is one thing that is very resonant with today, is looking at the ways in which candidates mobilize voters with what we would consider, what we call, you know, social issues, culture war, these things that had not been the focus of national political campaigns in the same way, and that sort of transformed the parties to orient around it. And so you're kind of hearing the beginnings of that. And I think that that's what we kind of trace to today.
How does the resignation of President Nixon in 1974 influence the events that occur in 1976?
There are two things I would call out. One is that when Nixon resigns, it is a watershed moment in the country. Kind of the place that we start is looking at this concept of trust in government, where, you know, writ large, American voters had largely believed in their government, had faith in their government, thought their government was trying to do the right things for them. And in part because of Watergate, I mean, that's a huge part of it, in part because of the Vietnam War, in part because of revelations about the CIA conducting illegal activities for, you know, decades in advance and all kinds of things, trust and faith in government collapses. And I think Nixon resigning is really the epitome of that. And so that has major ramifications for the kinds of candidates that we elect in this country, the kinds of candidates that run, the ways in which they run, what they campaign on. And, you know, I just mentioned sort of the idea of this of outsider candidates, you know, candidates who came in without very much experience in government, kind of running against the establishment. Watergate really opens the way for that in a lot of ways. And then the other part of it is that the Watergate also allows Ronald Reagan to run against Gerald Ford and set up this story, because if Nixon doesn't resign and Ford is not appointed president, then Ford is not a candidate for president. No one would have considered him a candidate for president. And so you don't have the seeds for this story in the first place.
You mentioned public trust.
Yeah.
And I would even take that a little further. I would go even back to questions raised in the aftermath of the assassination of President Kennedy, the Vietnam War, Watergate. So by the time we get to the mid-70s, as you referenced, not only has public trust evaporated, could you not argue that some 50 plus years later, we have not recovered from the public, from the lack of public trust that was baked in by the mid-70s?
I think that's exactly right. I think that's exactly right. And I think that the polls are pretty clear about that. When you ask voters, you know, do they trust their government? Do they believe in their government? Do they think their government has their best interests at heart? That has never recovered.
Talk about at the time of Nixon's resignation, how would you define the Republican Party in that moment, going in from, say, 74 into 1976? What does that party look like?
Yeah. So this is sort of a big question. And I think that until I started getting into this area of history and sort of, you know, studying polarization and the political parties, I didn't understand. And I think that probably most people don't have quite the conception of this either, which is that, you know, our parties today, Democratic Party and the Republican Party, they may have the same names, but they may as well be fundamentally different organisms, both in terms of what voters are in them and the way the parties operate. So if you go back to, let's say, 1974, when Nixon is resigning, the political parties historically, certainly since the New Deal, but I think you could argue pretty credibly going back much further, even, you know, close to their origins, that they had not primarily been ideological, right? Part of that is just based on technology. You have local parties and state parties, and then people from those go to conventions to nominate national candidates. So literally, you have these organizations that are, you know, state and local and concerned with state and local issues that are coming together to sort of into the sort of their own Congress to make national decisions and appoint a candidate. That was how the parties had operated. Part of that's technology. Part of that was also just because of their makeup. So both parties, Republicans and Democrats, had had people across the ideological spectrum within them. You know, I mean, you know, for better and worse. I mean, famously, Democrats have, you know, they're the party of the New Deal, and they have kind of, you know, liberal, college-educated, you know, voters that are sort of typified by the anti-Vietnam crowd. They tend to have people of color. They tend to have Black voters. This is sort of, you know, the New Deal people in cities, and then they also have, you know, the Dixiecrats, right? The Southern segregationists, who are a major faction in that party. So when you have that sort of wide spectrum of people in there, and, you know, parties, regardless of whether it's today or back then, are looking to achieve political power, the way that the parties operated back then was to try to sort of avoid social issues and culture war. And again, I mean, that's, you know, in some cases, very much for worse. But that was the way that they operated. The Republican Party was the same. The Republican Party had, you know, liberal voters, it had conservative voters. To some extent, if you were looking for what's the difference between them, the Republican Party is sort of more business oriented. The Democratic Party is the party of labor. But even then, the lines are not as starkly drawn as they are today, because you go back, you look at the New Deal, you look at the establishment of Social Security, the establishment during the Great Society of Medicare, you look at the Civil Rights Act, and all of these are drawing significant Republican votes. So because of that, the parties are not ideological. And the way that I think about this is, you know, if you are running an election, you are drawing a big circle around the American electorate of who you want to target and who you want your candidates to target. And both parties had sort of long drawn a big circle right around the center of American voters, right? And if you compare that to what the parties do today, they kind of draw circles around their bases, and it probably doesn't reach that far into the other party. Now, this had started to change. Richard Nixon, and before him, Barry Goldwater. So the two Republican presidential candidates, the Nixon being president for 8 years, had started to make overtures to Southern Democrats who were opposed to civil rights, who wanted to keep segregation, right? Goldwater is this, you know, quote unquote libertarian who says, oh, no, this is federal overreach. The federal government doesn't have the right to that, to do that, which also gives him some, you know, plausible deniability to say, oh, I'm not a racist. I just think that the federal government can't do this, right? So he can have some national appeal while taking this segregationist stance. So he starts to get Republican voters, but of course, he loses a landslide. I mean, just a huge blowout to Lyndon Johnson. So Richard Nixon, on the other hand, again, if you think about this kind of the big circles being drawn around the American electorate, for a variety of reasons, Nixon courts those same Southern Democrats. But at the same time, Nixon is also much more skilled than Barry Goldwater at reaching sort of the center of the American electorate. So his circle sort of goes from the middle of the American electorate all the way over to the right. And so he's running the Southern strategy. And so you've started to have this faction of conservatives that's growing in power, and they're upset by the fact that the Republican Party is still largely an unideological organization. So that's where we're at in 1974. You start to have this kind of bubbling up of resentment and rebellion from this conservative faction of Republicans, but they're not in control.
I was struck in Landslide. So while the things you just mentioned were going on, you in one of the early segments, I mean, there are reports that portray the Republican Party as a political organization on the cusp of oblivion. Some even mentioned they might be going the way of the Whigs.
Yes.
I mean, talk about that. So you have these dueling paradigms going on. Talk about that, yes, if you would.
Okay. So yes, that's a great point. Thank you. I know I just spent a long time giving you like kind of the history of the political parties. But yeah, there is this other thing, which is that Republicans have been getting just beaten in elections, with a few exceptions, for decades since the New Deal. You know, the New Deal coalition is bigger and it's better than the Republican coalition. And so, you know, there are more workers in the country than there are CEOs and managers and all of that. And that's, you know, that's sort of one of the dividing lines between the parties. So Republicans are already at a kind of a major disadvantage in terms of voter registration. But then after Watergate, people are so disheartened by Nixon and what has come out about it. And it's not just Watergate itself. You have to remember, you know, in the tapes, they show, one senator said, I'm paraphrasing here, that it just showed an utter lack of regard for any kind of consideration of what's best for the American people in the Watergate tapes. So people are so just turned off by the Republican Party that polls are doing exactly what you said, which is they're showing that only 18% of voters identify as Republicans. And there's sort of this amazing tape from the time where you hear kind of the political consensus, which is that, yeah, the Republican Party is going to die out, that it's going to go the way of the Whigs. So that was kind of the consensus. And the other aspect of that is that the people who are leaving the Republican Party at this time are more moderate people. So you have this block of conservatives. And as other people are leaving, those conservatives are growing stronger.
Let's discuss the evolution of Ronald Reagan, who went from fringe candidate, noted B-film movie star in 1966, to Republican mainstream and dominant orthodoxy by 1980. Talk about that evolution, if you will.
Well, that is the fascinating thing to me. I mean, in some ways, I think that drives our series and kind of is runs parallel to our driving question of kind of how did we get here, right? How did somebody who was viewed as really fringe end up becoming president, and then of course having this sort of, you know, iconic presidency where he's, you know, very revered by many Americans today. So just to establish who Reagan was, like you said, yes, noted B-movie actor, and his heyday had really been decades before. It had been before World War II. He was just starting to gain some heat as a serious actor, in addition to sort of a kind of a popular one, in the late 1940s. And I actually went and looked at, okay, well, what is he earning, and how does that compare to actors today? And sort of the equivalent would be a mid-2010s Michael Keaton. And so Reagan is that, but also he is sort of out of the movies at this point. And so he's found a home on television as a TV host. And the thing that he's most known for is in the 1950s and early 60s, he's the host of GE Theater, General Electric Theater, which would do sort of a movie of the week type thing. And Reagan would sometimes act in them, but he'd always introduce them. And then the other aspect of it was that GE put all of these gadgets in Reagan's Los Angeles home. And I don't know if you know about this, but we don't get into this in the series, but it is this sort of kind of fascinating tidbit where, you know, GE would build its new dishwasher, or its new laundry machine, or, you know, some new gadget, and they would install it into Reagan's home and kind of make it the home of the future. And then they would do these ads with Reagan, talking about GE products, but it was, you know, Reagan and his family, and they're having a nice breakfast, and it all looks so nice. And so in this other way, Reagan is becoming known to people, not necessarily as his characters, but as this image of himself, right? This reality TV image. And so that's you know, kind of the starting point. And again, you can see some parallels to a certain candidate today who came out of reality television and has been able to use that as a base. So on the other hand, Reagan is extreme politically in terms of the where he falls on the spectrum of mainstream American politics. So he kind of, while he's working for General Electric, General Electric is famously anti-union and very conservative from the sense of they kind of oppose government intervention. And it's called Boulwerism after after Boulware was the was one of the big wigs at GE and sort of in charge of this philosophy. And Reagan is going around the country giving speeches for General Electric, and at the same time he's sort of absorbing this doctrine. And he had already been, just to sort of give you the context on who Reagan was before that, he had been this staunch anti-communist. He had fed names to the FBI when he was the head of the Screen Actors Guild during the height of the Red Scare. And he really believes this kind of apocalyptic thing, which is that communism is going to sweep through and take over the country, and the U.S. is going to become this sort of totalitarian and communist country. So that's really what he believes. And again, that's very extreme. And so his ideology essentially becomes that any government program is leading us toward totalitarianism. And you hear this very distinctly when we go back and we look through sort of the archival tape of Reagan.
One of the things that you raise in Landslide was you talk about Reagan in 1966 defeating former Governor Pat Brown, who was a political heavyweight, and that Brown underestimated him. You can see Ford doing the same thing, and you can see Carter doing the same thing. but my question, what this raises for me, and I was curious to get your thoughts on it. Did they underestimate Reagan, or were they underestimating really how the American landscape was changing?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I don't know that I could parse out one or the other, but I would suspect it's probably a bit of both. But the other thing that I'm fascinated by, just as sort of a theme in tracing this stuff, is the degree to which candidates can change public opinion. I think that we will often think about, you know, voters and candidates sort of, you know, putting their finger into the wind and changing their positions to adapt to it. But I think that really powerful candidates can change what voters think. And so one of the examples that I always think about in the last few years would be, you could go to sort of the big lie, right? The idea that the erroneous idea that the 2020 election was stolen. You look at how many Republican voters believe that, and it's a majority of them, right? Despite the fact that there's just, you know, no evidence for it. Now, of course, there's, conservative media. There's different ways that this is sort of reinforced today. Go back to 2016. Look at Build the Wall, right? Build the Wall was an idea that the 16 other Republican candidates other than Donald Trump and essentially anybody else credible in the establishment writ large, regardless of their ideology, would tell you was a ridiculous idea. That building a wall along the border, a concrete wall, was a ridiculous, outlandish idea that had no business. And of course, by the end of that election, that's in the Republican Party platform. And you have, I don't know what the polls are on that, but certainly it's being campaigned on as sort of the big promise, by the Trump campaign. So candidates can change what voters think. And I don't think that we should disregard that when we also look at the ways in which this election and the people in it affected us today.
Can you cite a point where the Republican Party became dominated by, my words, the purity test, so which gives the emergence of the Rhino Republican in name only? When does it just become lockstep? You have to have this type of orthodoxy and this not as diverse as you originally described the two parties.
Yeah. You know, I think that there's a continuum, but the thing that we see over the course of the 1976 race is who's in charge. And by the end of the 1976 race, conservatives have won the Republican platform, and they have won, you know, they may not win the nomination, but Reagan is very clearly set up for 1980. And you can hear by the time you get to 1980 and into our last episode, just, you know, a little preview of that, you can hear some liberal Republicans who are still hanging on. You hear Senator, I think it's Mark Hatfield, who was an anti-Vietnam War Republican, who along with George McGovern had introduced some of the first legislation to strip funding from the war to make it end. And Hatfield is still a Republican. And he says, though, that not only do you have to be a conservative Republican in this party that he's looking at the 80 convention, but you have to be a Christian conservative, because you also have sort of the rise of the Christian right. And so, again, I think it's a continuum, because people like Hatfield are still Republicans. People like the party's chairwoman in 76, Mary Louise Smith, she remains a Republican. She campaigns for Ronald Reagan in the 1980s, even though she's a committed feminist who supports the Equal Rights Amendment and is pro-choice and all of those different kinds of things, because people had this conception of the party as sort of a separate tie than their ideology. So I think that it's a continuum. I think it fades over time. I think that 76 is a huge turning point, though, for that.
So can we cite that rise with only not only with conservatism within the Republican Party, but Ronald Reagan himself leading to the ouster of Vice President Nelson Rockefeller in the Ford administration?
Okay, so the ouster of Nelson Rockefeller being a not only a liberal Republican, but sort of the standard bearer for liberal Republicans and sort of this boogeyman to the conservatives, because he'd been the person who really challenged Barry Goldwater in 64. The appointment of Nelson Rockefeller by Gerald Ford. Gerald Ford's fairly conservative, at least economically. Rockefeller is the standard bearer for the liberals. It sort of shows that Ford wants to have a big tent. And when he appoints Rockefeller, there is this huge outcry from conservatives. And there's this network of grassroots activists called the New Right that we get into in our third episode. And they, the heads of the main people of the New Right, Richard Viguerie in particular, who's this sort of direct mail guru who kind of controls the information, points to the appointment of Rockefeller as sort of the inciting incident for everything that followed. So the toppling of Rockefeller is absolutely a significant moment in sort of charting the course of conservatives taking over.
If we didn't give any names,
yeah,
no dates, uh-huh, and I just said there was a new president takes office, and this president meets with the Congressional Black Caucus, this president meets with feminists, this president's wife is clearly in favor of the Equal Rights Amendment, you would think that I'm talking about AOC had become president. And this is Gerald Ford, right?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah. And that's, the, you know, he signs an extension of the Voting Rights Act. He signs the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday. You know, Ford was a conservative guy economically, and he was egalitarian in terms of, you know, social issues. And he also didn't want them to be sort of the key focus of politics. He just sort of wants to govern toward the center, even as he kind of wants less spending. And it's interesting that that's sort of doesn't exist in the same way in American politics today. Not that it doesn't exist at all, but that largely that's not an emphasis of either party. The degree to which sort of economic issues and defense issues, foreign policy, and social issues are tied together, I think, is one of the developments that we're tracing, right? So this idea that, you know, the example that I use is in here in California, I'm in LA, and there are these signs as you drive through the Central Valley, through the farmland. I'll be going up to the Bay Area to see my family. And there's these signs that say, build more dams. Of course, we have a water crisis in California. And the building dams is one policy option for storing more water. It has pros and it has cons. But underneath that, the sign also says, stop wasting our dam water. And of course, there's that other connotation to the word dam there. It adds a little bit of heat, a little bit of emotion. And then underneath that, it says, make California great again. And so you've turned a policy issue about the best ways to store water into a tribal issue. What tribe are you part of? And Gerald Ford absolutely was not part of that, right? So Ford thought politics should not be people in tribes. You know, Nelson Rockefeller, going back to him, sort of cries out, you hear him at one point say, I don't want to see one party of the right and one party of the left. So that was what those guys were doing at the time.
Would it be fair to suggest that Reagan took many of the social changes that were dominated by the 1960s, and he was able to portray those to a certain group of listeners as the existential threat, which you alluded to earlier, bears some similarity to the retort, make America great again?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, you know, the thing that gets people out to vote is emotion. One of the deepest emotions that we can feel is fear. And so Reagan was both able to, because he was a transcendent politician, he was able to both marry this sort of optimism in the way that he talked, saying, you know, we could just get government out of the way, that people can solve the problems. And that's very optimistic. While at the same time, presenting this vision of the current state of affairs in the country as, you know, almost apocalyptic, that things are going south, that, you know, the government is going to be totalitarian, that crime is off the charts, that, you know, the culture has gone wild. You know, this is in the 60s with hippies and the counterculture and drug use. And so he's very effective at painting that picture. And so I think that he sort of classically argues that there's this sort of dreamy vision of the past, of what America used to be, and that's what he wants to bring it back to. And so he both inspires fear in voters about what's happening currently and offers this optimistic vision of what he can bring. So I don't know if that fully answered your question.
Well, it may not fully answer my question, but it's a perfect segue to my next question. So okay. I thank you very much for that.
Great.
To that, you know, sort of idealistic vision that he paints, does the conservative movement rise in the same way without othering some group of people? I'm thinking of the Southern Strategy. I'm thinking of declarations of states' rights. I'm thinking of the mythical welfare queen. I'm thinking of the phony report that Reagan did. He took from Alameda County DA to talk about what's going on at UC Berkeley. I'm talking about the dehumanization of gays and lesbians, illegal immigration. I can just go on. Yeah. But at some point, does it rise the same way without this othering of these groups?
No, I don't think it does. I mean, I think that's very clear. I think that that's, you know, a very, that's, kind of a historical fact. I mean, the way that I look at it is what voters are supporting Reagan. And you have to ask yourself, when you look at Reagan and Ford, two very conservative guys, in terms of economics, in terms of, you know, how much they want the government spending, the size that they want the government to be, what's the difference? And who's voting for who? And what you watch over the course of the primaries is Ford winning in the Northeast and the Midwest, sort of traditional Republican areas, and Reagan winning the South. And what is the context of 1976? 1976 is just a little over a decade past the Civil Rights Act, past the Voting Rights Act. It is, you know, just the tail end of massive resistance. And, you know, at the time, you have, you know, thousands of segregation academies, schools that have been started specifically to keep out and still allow white students to not be around anyone other than white students. I mean, so if you're tracing it, you know, the Southern strategy is about peeling off Democrats who are upset about civil rights, who do not want an end to segregation, and bring them into the Republican column. And that forms a new coalition. And you're absolutely right. Those other movements that you mentioned, you know, the women's rights movement, the gay rights movement, absolutely the coalition that's being built is around those issues. And in particular, I mentioned the New Right before, who are these sort of allies of Reagan. They're kind of frenemies throughout history, because whenever Reagan is actually in office and governing, and he's willing to compromise, they get very upset, because they're sort of no compromise. But during the campaigns, they tend to be allies. And the New Right is specifically built around what they call organizing discontent. And that means over social issues, over textbooks, over integration, those kinds of things. So that's what the coalition is, right? I mean, how do you build a conservative coalition in the country? What Reagan essentially does is he takes the conservative wing of the Republican Party, the conservative wing of the Democratic Party, social and cultural conservatives, and builds them into a coalition. And so that's new. And I think that there's no question that, you know, that anti-integration, and what would we call that other than racism, is one of the key driving forces. And that doesn't mean that there aren't voters that are inspired by because they feel like they're paying too many taxes. It doesn't mean that there aren't voters inspired because they're worried about losing the Cold War. But, you know, every individual voter is sort of their own unique snowflake. You know, you interview any kind of person on the street, and you're going to find they have, you know, a really interesting mix of views. But voters writ large, when we look at groups of voters, we can see some pretty simple and powerful forces. And it's really clear that force is at work in creating the Republican coalition that we're familiar with today.
I know much of Landslide, not all of it, much of Landslide really talks about this intramural battle within the Republican Party. But when you look at the present landscape, at least my view, it seems to me that we've become these two divisive parties. If our side does it, it's fine. There are legitimate reasons for it. If the other side does it, it's deplorable. Is that an oversimplification, or have we morphed to that and sort of beginning with 76 to get to this point?
Yeah, I think it's a good question. I mean, I think that, and I don't know that I'm fully qualified to answer it. The things that I do know are that the element of polarization that has grown the most is what's called negative polarization. And you've probably covered it on this show before, which is the degree to which people dislike people of the opposite party, right? So even if you are sort of part of a party, or you're independent, but you tend to vote with one party, you may not love that party, but you almost certainly have strong feelings, strong negative feelings about people in the other party. And so what does that do, right? If you think that the people in the other party and the other party taking power is a fundamental threat to your well-being, then you're willing to sanction behavior among people who are your allies to prevent that you might not otherwise sanction.
It appears, at least to me, in the present moment, that Reagan, the name Ronald Reagan, has become more of an avatar who's used almost like a modifying noun, justifying whatever comes after his name is invoked. How do you see that?
Well, you know, I think that Reagan had an iconic presidency, was an incredibly popular president. You know, that's the tail end of the Soviet Union, the end of the Cold War. You'd had this decade in the 70s of stagflation, you know, economic fall. People for the first time thought that their children would not have it better off than they'd had it, right? That their children were not going to be wealthier. We're not going to be happier. We're not going to be more prosperous. And so when Reagan takes over in the 80s, and the first 2 years go pretty poorly, it's sort of those same forces, but then there's a recovery, right? There's an economic recovery. You have the end of the Cold War, those kinds of things. People stop feeling that way. Again, you know, kind of writ large. And so it gives him this status. And I think that therefore for most people, myself included, who have grown up in a world that is post-Reagan, you have this view of this sort of iconic president. But it's important to look at how he got there, what drove him, and what his beliefs were. And so I think that there's a contrast there.
Well, his rhetoric versus his governing are not carbon copies. I mean, sure. Reagan was not nearly as strident in governing as he may have appeared during the campaign. And I yet to hear people today, when they invoke the name of Reagan, talk about his willingness to do a deal, to compromise, to move the country forward in his view.
No, you're absolutely right. And both in California as governor and as president, you know, Reagan had divided government. So in California, in the legislature, that was largely Democrats. And same thing was true in Congress. And he, you know, he wins the Senate in 1980, and it's this huge moment for Republicans. But he's dealing with divided government throughout the entire time. And ultimately, he believed in what he called, you know, taking half a loaf, you know, if you can't get the whole loaf. And so that was, you know, a pragmatic view of governing. And there's no question that he had that. And he did have, you know, he would maintain his sort of scorched earth rhetoric, even as he was doing that. So I think that he was effective in that way. I think he was effective often as a manager, in that he was willing to appoint people to just sort of take over and let them sort of pursue his priorities. And then, of course, you know, Iran-Contra hangs in the background of that. And I don't know how that necessarily plays in, but both in California and in Washington, D.C., I think that he displayed an effectiveness in getting his priorities through, and a willingness to compromise that allowed him to do it. And I think he probably got better at that over time, over the course of his time in California. So you're absolutely right. That very much was there.
Does conservatism, however you're defining it, especially during challenging times, possess an embedded advantage in a democracy, because oftentimes it offers a more simplistic solution to what are increasingly insoluble problems, and that makes them more appealing?
You know, that question is beyond my pay grade. I would say that Reagan in particular, what we hear in the series is that he sort of changes the rhetoric of conservatism. So instead of naysaying, he creates this sort of positive force behind it, which is, again, the idea that, you know, if the government will just get out of people's way, that all of a sudden the people will be able to solve problems for less money and more efficiently. And it's sort of this golden vision that's predicated on less government. And he's able to sort of use that for all kinds of different priorities, whether it's, you know, kind of fighting against social issues and, you know, and social movements, or whether it's spending, or, you know, things along those lines. It's interesting to compare that to today, because I would say that optimism is less prevalent in our current politics. But whether one has an advantage over the other, I don't know. A thing that I do think is that if you look at the development of the political parties, the Republican Party has, while it always has had divisions within itself, those divisions have been less prominent than among the Democratic Party, right? Which even today has sort of the last vestiges of the New Deal, where you have a few kind of culturally conservative, you know, labor union members, in addition to sort of more socially liberal people. You have people of color who often on social issues, if you look at polling, tend to be more conservative than, again, that sort of, you know, white liberal wing of the Democratic Party. And so the divisions are more stark, and that muddies a party's message. And Republicans have not had to deal with that in the same way, which maybe makes their message more effective. But again, that's probably above my pay grade.
Mm-hmm. Nothing's above your pay grade on the public rally. So you're in safe waters here, sir.
I appreciate that.
What do you have? Two more episodes left. Is that correct?
We have three. So episode four just came out. Yeah, we're just about to get into one of my favorite parts of the story, which is the Democratic primary and what's happening over there, where the front runner is George Wallace, the racist Alabama governor who stood in the schoolhouse door to block integration, is considered to be the front runner for the Democratic nomination. And Wallace had been this huge force in national politics. And you wonder, I mean, what do the parties look like if Wallace, of all people, is the Democratic nominee? But instead, this other Southern governor emerges, or former Southern governor emerges. He's ranked 24th in a list of voter preference at the beginning of the race. No one knows who he is, and that's Jimmy Carter. And Carter's rise is fascinating for, again, looking at the direction of the Democratic Party, and also just other forces in our politics that we sort of take for granted today. So we're about to get into that.
So when this is all said and done, in a perfect world, what would you like for listeners to take away?
I just think that when we're trying to make sense of the forces at work in today's politics, understanding where they came from, being able to trace the various threads that are still playing out today, is really important. And I think that it's pretty clear that politics today is pretty fraught, that we are in a moment of crisis. And if we're looking for ways out of it, maybe by looking to the past and really understanding what it is that we're actually looking at today can help us. Yeah, go ahead, please.
No, I was going to say, so in addition to the podcast version, people can also find it online, Spotify. I mean, all the ways you can find Landslide.
It is available wherever you get your podcasts. So it's on Apple Podcasts and Spotify and all those kinds of things. We have a website. This is a production of my company, which is Nuanced Tales. It's in partnership with the public radio station in Charlotte, North Carolina, WFAE, one of my old employers. And it's distributed by the NPR network. And I tell you that mouthful just because, one, there's the public radio affiliation, which I feel very strongly about, as I know you do. And two is that our website is at wfae.org/landslide. But we don't have at the moment, we have some extra content. We have all of our sources and citations that you don't hear in the episode posted there. So these are, you know, the dozens of books and hundreds of articles and all those kind of things that form the research for what we're saying. And then we have an Instagram page where there actually are extras. So that's at Landslide History. And again, I don't say that just to plug it, but also because we do have these outtakes and other stories. So the one I would call out just very briefly is we look at Ronald Reagan's career. We don't have time to do this in the actual episode before he was an actor. And I don't know if you know this, but he got his start on air as a sportscaster calling baseball.
He did the Cubs games, right?
He did White Sox games. But the thing about it is that while he's making the calls on the radio, he's not actually at the games. In fact, he had never been to a single game because at the time, the technology didn't exist to broadcast from the games. You had to do it from a radio studio. So instead, he's getting these slips of paper via telegraph where he can pull out and look at the slip of paper and it says, his example is S1C, which means strike one called. And then he has to make up what happened. You know, it's high to the right and slides in just on the edge of the plate or whatever it is. I probably just betrayed my lack of baseball knowledge. And he would make those kind of calls and sort of spin it from whole cloth. He'd use a little pedal to to push in crowd noise. And this was not a secret. People knew that this was how it was done. People would even come and watch him do it. And he gained kind of regional fame in the Midwest for this. But it speaks to his sort of political talent later in a way that probably his acting even doesn't, where, you know, he could spin these stories that were so compelling. So we have things like that on our Instagram page.
Well, to your point about Ronald Reagan and baseball, if anyone is interested, if you go to YouTube, there is a clip of him at the All-Star game in San Diego talking with Vin Scully, and he actually makes a call. And you can see this guy's really good.
Yeah, there's no question. Yeah, we have a little archival tape from when he was president where he was reminiscing about how he used to do it. And he gives an example and you can absolutely hear it. You know, you hear the voice there and all that. So he did that when he was in his 20s. And that was sort of his springboard into Hollywood, was that he had this sort of regional fame and some other kind of sportscasters had made the transition and even used a trip to, I think it was spring training, as his excuse to get down to Los Angeles to start meeting with Hollywood executives.
Well, Ben Bradford, I want to thank you so much for joining me on the Public Rally. And for those, you must listen to Landslide. It will give you some insight into who we are today based on what occurred some 50-some years ago. Thank you for joining me today, sir.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
The Public Rally welcomes your comments. You can contact me at Byron@publicmorality.org. That's Byron, Byron, at publicmorality.org. You can follow me on Facebook as well as Twitter. The archive broadcast can be found on iTunes, Spotify, Amazon Prime, SoundCloud, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Those listening to the Public Rally on WSNC can also listen on an app. Using your mobile device, simply go to your application page, search WSNC 90.5, and click open to listen from anywhere. The Public Rally is produced at WSNC on the campus of Winston-Salem State University. For all of us at the Public Morality, I'm Byron Williams.